can survive if I let you.
Conquering nevermore.
Let the new era begin. The era of the ECW.
Oh my god.
Greetings, ECW fans, and welcome to This Is Extreme, an ECW history podcast. I am your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining us for another episode, and we have a really fun episode, right? We have today longtime ECW referee John Finnegan on, and by longtime, I mean from beginning to end. John was there for the entire run, and as I mentioned later, John is the man that Todd Gordon called the best referee in the business. John is a great guy, has a lot of great stories. And again, he experienced the entire run of ECW, so he has lots of insight into the promotion. I don't have a lot to get into before we get to that. One thing I did want to touch on is we talk about, I've been talking about lots of historical dates and title changes, things. I'm not going to do that here on the podcast anymore because I think it's kind of boring listening. So if you want to get those things, though, they are still on the social media for the podcast. So make sure you follow us on those. We are on X, Twitter, Instagram, and Threads. Just look up ECW Pod, and you'll be able to see all those historical dates, title changes, birthdays, all of that there. And then you can also follow me personally on X at The Dave Dynasty. Now, before we get to our interview with John, I do want to make one point of ECW significance. On October 25th, episode of AEW Dynamite, Rob Van Dam was on there again, and he teamed once again with Hook, and they defeated the Dark Order. It's nice to see Rob out there working. He still, again, still looks great. And I think the team with him and Hook is kind of cool, right? It kind of works. It taps into the history of ECW with Rob Van Dam and Taz. And it's kind of neat. And I know Van Dam said on his podcast, I think recently, that he'd like to continue to tag with Hook. And if he had his way, he would call the tag team Smoke and Choke. And that's pretty funny. Pretty hilarious. So here's hoping we get to see more of Rob Van Dam in AEW. It's always great seeing these guys out there still doing their thing. And again, Rob looks great, right? Doesn't look like he's lost a step over the years. So that's all I got here to open up. I'm excited to get to this interview. I'm excited for you to hear it. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I'll have ECW referee John Finnegan on. So hang in there.
Be sure to follow This Is Extreme on all social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for ECW Pod. Be sure to follow us, keep up to date, and join in the discussions. We want to hear your feedback, so find us on all the social media platforms and join the revolution. This is
Extreme. All right, and we're back on This is Extreme, and we're joined by an ECW original. Not only an original guy, it was there from the inception to the end. And a guy who Todd Gordon calls the best referee in the business, John Finnegan. John, how are you?
Good, Dave. How you doing?
I'm very good. Thank you for joining us. And I want to start where I always start. I always ask people, first off, how did you become a fan of professional wrestling?
I've been watching it since probably 5 years old with my grandmother. Okay. Saturday mornings with her, or later on Saturday nights after Lawrence Welk. I had to go through Lawrence Welk to get to pro wrestling. But she loved both, and that's what started it.
Yeah, that's my grandma got me interested, actually, too. I'm from Central Indiana originally, and we got a little bit of everything. We got Bruiser TV, and then we also got the Memphis stuff out of Louisville. And my grandma would watch anything, and she actually got me started. She was the first.
You know, that's the same of mine. She just wanted to see a fight, no matter what it was. Yeah, she loved it.
Yeah, and she was the atypical, you know. Cheer the faces, boo the heels. She fell right in line.
The way it should be.
That's right. Yeah, she was your prototypical ringside granny. That you always see at the shows. So how did you then make the transition to getting started wrestling? Who trained you? How did you get involved and start refereeing?
I lived in Philly until I was 9, and we moved over to South Jersey. And I learned that Buddy Rogers was right in Haddonfield, not even 10 minutes from my house. Actually, let me back up. I never tell this part of the story because it still pisses me off to this day. My original job, I was in purchasing, and we went to a lot of different lunch functions with vendors and stuff like that. And there was a restaurant in Cherry Hill that had this, I forget the charity, but had an annual luncheon with all local sports celebrities. Okay. And Gorilla Monsoon was always there.
Oh, yeah.
So I went to the lunch, luncheon with my boss and had all intentions of going up to Monsoon, which I did, and asked him, hey, how do you get into the business? And he worked me up one side and down the other. Look, you work real hard and do this and do that, and you never know what'll happen. And later on in life, I found out he just worked the hell out of me. I had no interest whatsoever in telling me. So I usually leave that part of the story out, but every now and then it just ticks me off, but I always kind of take a shot.
Yeah.
But I actually went up to Buddy Rogers' house, knocked on his front door, because I knew he was involved with Larry Sharp and the Monster Factory at the time.
Right. Yep.
And he opened the door, invited me in, had me in there for like an hour. We were talking wrestling. He says, listen, I'm getting out of the school business, but go see Larry. He'll take care of you. The next night I went to the school. Larry was on vacation, and Dick Worley was there watching the school for him.
Right.
And I was talking to Dick, and Dick, without directly ripping Larry, was ripping Larry and pretty much telling me, just watch yourself. Give him a shot. Come back when he's back. Hear what you want to hear, and then let me know what you think. So a week later, I went back. Larry was there, and all Larry wanted to talk about was how I was going to pay him, how quick I could pay him, and that was it. Kind of turned me off, and I left. Next day, I called Dick. He says, listen, I'll take you around. At that time, it was a lot of athletic commissions. He was hooked up with Jersey, PA. I don't know if he did New York. I don't think he did a lot of New York, but mostly New Jersey and PA. And me and my father drove out to Atlantic City, Tropicana, to meet him. That's when AWA was doing the TV tapings there. And he sat down with us, and he agreed to payment terms. He would let me do installments, and we actually filled out a contract, which I just found not long ago, the copy of him and me signing it, and I still have that to this day. And he was great. He was great with my dad. A week later, I was starting to travel with him all around the different shows in Jersey and PA. And actually, he was involved in Maryland, too. Yeah. We went down to Baltimore a few times when he was doing NWA shows.
Yeah. Did you know you were a referee right off the bat? Is that what you?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. I had no interest in wrestling. I wanted to be involved I wanted to be more involved in once a night kind of a referee. You're involved throughout the show. Sure. Yep. And you do a lot more. And that's always what I wanted to do. And Dick took me around with him. We got the shows early, worked out with a lot of superstars back then, wherever shows we were at. Really, I got lucky. The night that I went to Monster Factory, he was there. It was pure luck. He just happened to be there when Larry wasn't. And from that on was, as they say, was history.
Yeah. So you traveled with Dick then just in work shows where he was going? And
I traveled for a year and a half before I actually had my first match.
Okay.
And he, like I said, we got there early a lot of times, got in the ring, see if I knew. You know, it's funny. He really never showed me step by step or anything like that, what you should or shouldn't do. He kind of watched what I did and would tell me if I shouldn't do or don't do. So he seemed to be very, I don't toot my own horn, but he seemed to be impressed that I knew what I was doing a lot of the time. And he was great. He knew a lot of people. Again, more luck then too. Back that time, getting involved in wrestling, it was a lot of, like I said, athletic commissions, and he knew every promoter there was to know.
Yeah.
So anytime he was booked, he got me booked with him.
Yeah. Skip ahead a little bit. You started referring that the tri-state shows, right? How did that happen?
Yes. I was doing a lot of New Jersey indies. Joel Goodhart came up to me, and that's when one of the first feuds I remember getting happened between him and Carluzzo and Larry Sharp. They were kind of butting heads back and forth, doing their own areas and local shows. And Joel came up to me one time. We were at the Marriott in Philly. It was a big hangout after NWA or Spectrum wrestling shows, and all the fans and wrestlers were there. They all hung out together, and Joel was there, and he came up and pulled me aside. He says, hey, I'm going to start running these shows. I actually want to put a school together. I'd love to have you train the refs and be my referee on all the shows. And that was that. Yeah, I hit it off with Joel early, just on the indie scene when he was doing a lot of ring announcing stuff with different shows. And I just hit it off with him and got friendly with him. And he came to me when he had the opportunity for me.
Yeah, the Northeast was, it's kind of ahead of its time a little bit, right? Because it started what we know now is indie wrestling, right? It was doing things like that. You had Joel and, like you said, Corluzzo and those guys doing these big shows, bringing in, former WWE, WCW talents to headline and using a lot of the Northeast guys. And that was, it was kind of the, I don't know how to describe it, right? It's the territories were gone, and this was kind of the new thing.
Well, maybe there's maybe a little bit left in it. I would actually consider that a territory, the Northeast. Jersey, New York, PA, Delaware. A lot of shows I did, DC Drake, Larry Winters, Mike Kahlua. You saw those guys all over, and they kind of went from different spots. There was people who had TV. There was people who was doing regular monthly shows. It was a pretty, again, lucky. When I started, I was lucky to be able to be in that environment and be able to have those different opportunities in the different states. And I would call it the territory. It kind of ran that way. It was probably the last of the old school mentality.
Yeah, and of course, then Joel, you know, he had some money issues, right, with the one show that he kind of lost a lot on, and it kind of had him having to close the door, right? And then that's where it kind of transitioned over. Todd Gordon was going to, quote-unquote, take over that territory, that area.
That's right. Yeah, Todd actually got involved before Joel folded. He was behind the scenes. Not a lot of people know that, but he was involved a little bit before the end.
Yeah.
And was helping Joel out.
Yeah.
And Joel would just overbook shows with too many big stars, just too damn expensive.
Yeah.
And it got worse and worse, and eventually he just had to shut the doors. But yeah, then Todd took it over.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Buddy Rogers earlier, right? That was one of the last shows where he kind of lost, right? He was trying to
supposed to be the big last show, him versus Buddy Landell.
Yeah, the Nature and, Boy versus Nature Boy.
I was actually really disappointed that didn't happen because I was really looking forward to doing that. But yeah, that was going to be his last big show. I'm actually surprised he didn't at least try to do that one because there was a lot of buzz for it.
Yeah.
Just the Buddy match. There was a lot of people interested in that, but I guess he was just too deep in debt to even attempt it.
Yeah, and I think I heard you talk on another interview then when Todd kind of sat down with Larry Winters and some of these guys and said, okay, we're going to do this, you know, kind of spinning out of the TWA. And you were there, right? I mean, you were in that.
Yes, I was at one of the second meetings. The first meeting, I believe it was Todd, Bob Ortiz, Larry Winters, a couple other people. I was not at that initial one. I was at one of these Springfield skate rink that Bob then called a few of our guys that have been around me and Jim and told us what was going on. And Todd's another guy I hit it off from the beginning with, and to this day we're good friends.
Yeah.
And I owe a lot to him. But Todd wanted to get it rolling.
Yeah, and obviously those early days, right, in Eastern Championship Wrestling, it felt a lot like Tri-State, right? There's a lot of the same guys. But Todd was starting to put his own stamp on things here and there. And then one of the initial things he did that kind of was a little different, right? He brought in Eddie Gilbert to book. And him and Eddie were, you know, pretty close. And what was that like? Because, you know, Eddie Gilbert's he's a fascinating character, right? I mean,
he's a very, very interesting individual. An unbelievable mind for the business.
Right, yeah.
A great wrestler, worker, promo guy. Mm-hmm. Just had, I hate the term demons, but he just had his personal issues that just destroyed him.
Yeah.
And eventually that's what Todd had to just get away from him.
Yeah, and then obviously then, like you said, when he got away, he transitioned to Paul Heyman, right, who Paul was in. And, you know, Paul was going to work with Crockett to try to revive NWA. And supposedly, right, he was working with Todd to kind of see how some of these Northeast guys, right, to give some of his guys, Paul was going to give some of his guys some ring time, right?
And that's correct. He had some New York guys that he wanted to bring down. It was funny, the first time I saw Paul there, we were in one of the Caprini College TV tapings, and I came around into the locker room, and there's Paul Heyman sitting there. I said, I'm thinking, where'd you come from? What are you doing here? And we were just talking for a little bit, and he said he was obvious. Well, we knew he was friends with Eddie, but he was here for Eddie and talking to Todd and just wanted to help out and try to get some of his guys down, just get some exposure.
Yeah. And Todd always said, like, you know, in his book, and when I talked to him, him and Paul clicked instantly, right? And it was, you know, they were just gelled. Had a lot of, you know, he said a lot of the same humor, a lot of the mindset and everything else. Like you said, you were there from, you know, Tri-State through these early days of Eastern. What did it feel when it transitioned kind of from Eddie to Paul? Could you feel a change in the style, the booking, the locker room feel at all?
Probably Paul, but Paul can talk you off the ledge of a,
of course,
or make you jump off the ledge of a building. He's got that unique talent to make you run through a wall or anything like that. And that he seemed to be more, Eddie wasn't a real rah-rah guy. He was more nuts and bolts, and this is what I want to do. And Paul was more, let you put input, different mindset, different approach to the whole business. But similar, because they were together for so long, him and Eddie, they've been around together for a while. But just a different mindset.
Yeah, I mean, Paul obviously has a great mind, right? I mean, he's had a great career. He's very creative. But was his style a little more, I don't know how to describe it, fly by the seat of your pants? You know, you never knew who was going to be there, right? In these early, I mean, guys weren't under contracts. So you got to kind of go with the flow, right? Did it feel like that of, hey, we don't, sometimes it was in flux to almost showtime and taping time?
Not sometimes, all the time.
All the time.
We didn't get a lineup. I'm going to say 90% of the time, me, Bob Ortiz, Jim Mollen, the other refs, Paul, till literally 10 of 8. The show started 8 o'clock. I'm going to go by arena shows because they were our big TV taping shows. He was looking around the room to see who was there because he probably didn't even know who half the people were going to be there or not there.
Yep.
And he's looking around to see what he had. And we literally were putting lineups together at 10 of 8.
Yeah, it's crazy, though, how even, booking like that, there was still some fluidity to it, right? He knew how to hit those curveballs, right? And transition.
He definitely knew what to do, even with that last minute approach, as far as booking goes.
Right. Yeah.
He was second to none with it. But unfortunately, he had that same mentality when he was paying people and paying bills.
Yeah.
And trying to get.
I was going to say the financial side, maybe not so much.
That's unfortunately what eventually killed everything.
Yeah. Which is, probably another good reason that Todd and Paul worked so well together, right? Because Todd was not like that as far as the financial side.
No.
He was a business owner, grew up in a business family, and knew how to handle the business side. And he just, unfortunately, I think Paul kind of got away from him a little bit.
I think that's exactly what happened. They just started to grow apart, and I'm sure more Todd than Paul. Todd was more, I just can't take this anyway. We just can't operate this way anymore. I mean, I've done all my life. My family's done all their life this way, and it's got to be this way. And Todd just had to get out before he went broke.
Right. Yeah. Well, and obviously, then, like we said, ECW transitioned from Eastern to Extreme. And how did that change for you guys as referees? Because right in Extreme, obviously the rules are very loose. There wasn't really DQs per se. So how did you, coming from a more traditional, referee role, how did you have to kind of evolve into the Extreme role?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people say that, but I think there was a lot more structure than people give it credit for as far as a match going. I mean, there was a lot of craziness and chaos, mm-hmm. but I mean, majority of the time we attempted to enforce rules and counts and stuff like that. That's why I thought ECW shows were so unique. You had the crazy, you had the wrestling, you had the women, you had the luchadors when they came in, and it was a lot of different stuff that I think put the whole show together. So there was a lot of everything.
Yeah, it's always kind of driven me mad because everybody they hear ECW, they think, oh, it's barbed wire and blood. And there was comedy, there was this, that, but there was some of the best technical, I mean, all your great workers of that time, the Dean Malenkos, the Eddie Guerreros, who shined there and got their first chances there. And like you said, the luchadors, they got their exposure. Yep. And there was so much more there than just the blood and guts. For someone who really watched the show.
I'll argue to this day that it just wasn't blood and guts. And, I'm not a real big Cody, I guess what you call it today, deathmatch wrestling fan of today.
Yeah.
And I'll be the first to criticize. I think it's just gratuitous nonsense.
Which was not ECW at all.
No. No reason whatsoever. And people always say to me, well, don't you remember where you came from?
Yeah.
I say, I know where I came from. And it was more structured and different. It wasn't just blood and guts. There was a reason for doing everything that we did. And like you said, there was a lot of wrestling. I say it to this day. Loved working Dean Malenko and Eddie Guerrero matches. One of my favorites ever.
Yeah.
Rob Van Dam and Jerry Lynn. On and on and on the different wrestling matches and matchups that we had. But yeah, I hate when people say, it was just all blood and guts.
Yeah. I mean, it felt, I've heard it before, but I think it's true. I think it's very Memphis-like, right? And ECW, right? Memphis was a violent territory, right? It had that, that heart, people say hardcore originated in Memphis, but then there was a mixture, right? There was comedy in Memphis, and that's the same way with ECW. It was just the 90s version of that, right? The 90s take on that.
Sure. I agree completely. I mean, one of the biggest things out of Memphis was Andy Kaufman and Jerry Lawler.
Yep, absolutely.
Borderline comedy, borderline serious, borderline a little bit of everything. I think that's why people still remember it to this day. It was way ahead of its time pulling something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you could always tell when Jerry Lawler was booking, right? Because you'd have the monsters, right? The Frankensteins and the mummies. Right. I mean, come That's on. Right. How much more comedy can you get than that?
Yeah.
And like we said earlier, obviously, Paul became more influential, right? Came more in control and eventually took control of ECW. And Todd Gordon talks a lot about in his book and how he felt a little deceived, right? A little misled. And he's kind of come clean on some of that. But I want to ask you, because I know you're very close to Todd. You've always been very close to Todd. When that happened, how did that affect you at all and your how you felt? Because not only did you work for Todd, but you were friends with Todd. And you obviously had to know, hey, this is happening. This is not maybe not on the up and up, but you're also an employee working for Paul now.
Right. You had to walk on eggshells with it. But, yeah, I really felt bad for Todd. I mean, Paul put out money and his family's money and all that, but Todd's life was put on the line from the very beginning. His family, his businesses, and he's the one that got it all going and put the ECW in the position to where Paul took it from there. And, yeah, I felt bad. It was I hated to see him go out that way. He didn't deserve it.
Yeah, and I talked to Todd, and I told him this. I mean, no disrespect to Paul, right? Paul's a genius creatively, whatever else. But there would have been no Paul Heyman ECW without Todd Gordon. I mean, Todd Gordon, you know, he built it, created it, and he brought Paul in and put him in that position to do those things. So, and it, you know, and I'm glad, like I said, with Todd with his book and he's doing some appearances, he's getting a little more credit. And again, that's not to knock Paul, but it's, you know, I think Todd deserves a little more credit for his stamp on ECW.
Completely agree. Yeah, he deserves the majority of it. Like I said, he's the one who got it going. Yeah.
And then you, let's talk, eventually ECW, right, lands on pay-per-view. There's barely legal, right? And you hear all these stories, right, of the power going off right after and Paul in his speech, and lots of guys have verified and talked about this. But tell me your memories from that night and being in your role.
Total chaos. It was from start to finish to the end of the night. Like we just talked about earlier with the last minute putting a booking, a show together 10 minutes before bell time. At least that didn't happen. I mean, we had a set match set and all that, but it was new to everybody. So, I mean, a lot of people were on edge. A lot of people were nervous. You saw guys that were been in the business for years, the Terry Funks and the Shane Douglases, and just the environment was tense. And you could tell. You could tell that on everybody. And at the end, that's a true story at the end with the power going out.
Yeah.
And I think at the end of it's funny because I just saw the Terry Funk Raven finish not long ago. And I forgot that I did this, but when I hit the three count, actually it was DDT'd before that. And then when I hit the three count for him to finally win, I kind of did a bump back like out of exhaustion, like, oh my God, thank God it's over. And it was like everybody was just in the ring like, oh. Done. It's done. Type of deal.
Yeah.
And it was a crazy, stressful day.
Yeah. And you always hear about ECW, right? That it's mom and pop, right? Everybody pitched in. Taz helped with shirts and all these guys. Is that truly that day? Is that what it was? Everybody was just running around.
Absolutely. I mean, you had guys, you running into towns early to promote buildings, to lock up buildings, Bubba and Lou DeAndres, who was signed Guy Dudley, did a lot of the behind the scenes. Jack Victory, when he came aboard, he did a lot of the promoting. Like Taz did all the merch, and Tommy Dreamer. I don't know how Tommy Dreamer came to the show and had a match. From all the stuff he probably did from Monday to the next Sunday to the next Saturday or to the next weekend.
Yeah.
He did. He was involved in everything.
Yeah, and I think to me that's part of the magic of ECW, right? Because it's not just a company. It's not just a show where guys were coming in, working, leaving. Everybody was so invested. And I think that's what helped bring, because you always hear that family feel that ECW had in the locker room and that Island of Misfit Toys type deal, right, where these guys that couldn't make it anywhere else, and here they were working together, banding together to do this. And I think, you know, that was the energy and specialness, right, of ECW, is that everybody was so invested in doing their part. You were obviously, like I said, there from beginning to end. Did you agree with that? I mean, was that part of the specialness?
I mean, it even goes above even the guys in the locker room. It even goes as far as with the fans. I mean, even the fans became a part of the show and a part of the whole presentation. And I've been in a lot of locker rooms in 37 years, and there was nothing nothing to, like the camaraderie in ECW and what everybody did. Everybody had the same goal. They want to put on the greatest show every night for the fans, no matter what it took. No egos, put them all aside, and just go out there and work your ass off. And that's exactly what every match did.
Yeah, and it's pretty remarkable because I would say ECW is one of the first to kind of – they booked some to the smart fans, right? Because Paul knew what dirt sheets were. Obviously, was aware of them and participate, you know, read them or whatever. And it was wild because it seemed like he had his finger on the pulse to know, hey, this is where the business is going, right? The curtain's starting to open up a little bit, and we can't just deny that, right? So you have to try to work the guys that think they can't be worked.
Which was one of my favorite moments.
Yeah.
Is when watching the people that you had all your regulars in the front row,
yep,
on the camera side, and watching them be shocked, mm-hmm, on multiple occasions. My favorite one is when Arn Anderson and Bobby Eaton came in the arena.
Yep.
Never saw a reaction like that in that building. Nobody had any idea. Those people were stunned when they came in.
Yep.
And that's the way, like you said, that's how Paul started to saw it happening, and he had to start working the people that thought they knew everything.
Yeah, he had this weird sense of things like that, like with music and everything. It was so odd how it's a marvel, right? How he knew. It's like he was one step ahead of what was going to be hip. And it's like he knew a song to put on or to, you know, whatever, lift or use. And before it was, a big thing, you know, it was pretty great, right? He booked to the time.
Yeah, it was genius. Smart. I mean, I sometimes I hate giving my wife sitting across from me right now, and she hates when I use the word genius when it comes to Paul Heyman.
Yeah,
well, a couple of dollars and they still be coming my should have been coming my way, but everybody has that problem.
Yeah,
but he's a genius. He is a wrestling genius. To put it, I don't care what you say. A businessman, he's horrible.
Oh yeah, no doubt.
Talking to you sometimes face to face, horrible individual. Lying right to you.
Yep.
But the man is a genius when it comes to professional wrestling.
Yep. I mean, so wild that you always hear people that say you could know he's lying, but yet somehow you die for him, right? He just knew how to talk, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's that lawyer, you know, he had a lawyer dad and he learned some of the tricks or what.
I completely agree with that. I'm sure he did. He learned a lot from his parents.
Yeah.
And especially his father.
Yeah. And then later, obviously, ECW landed on TNN, right? And on national TV. What was, when you guys did that, what was the feel? Did you feel like, hey, this is a big lift for us? Did I know Paul was, there was turmoil. But did Paul sell it to you like, hey, we're saved, right? We're on national TV.
Oh, of course. I mean, he made it look like rainbows and unicorns. But yeah, I never liked the TNA run.
Yeah.
I didn't think TNA it presented
felt,
us well.
Yeah, it felt
we're
weird.
Not behind us. I just didn't like it. I mean, it was great. More people got to see it, but it just I didn't think it ever worked right.
No, it felt like an odd fit, right? Because TNN was still a country channel, right? It was still known as that. And here you had ECW, which was definitely not that. And I think that's part of it. It's like they were just filling time. And I know there was all the talk of the potential of going to Spike and, you know, whatever, and WWE and stepped in and whatever. Spike would have been a much better fit for ECW. I think it would have worked.
Completely
a lot
agree. Yeah. I don't know what happened with that. Who knows? But yeah,
no one knows.
It definitely would have been, a different, whole different story.
Yeah. I mean, but you know, you could play the coulda, woulda, shoulda thing all the time, but
right,
who knows? But
right.
So you mentioned it, and I was going to ask you. So you did encounter some of the pay issues, right, at the end of ECW. Always
year
talks,
and a half, right? Year and a half to the end. You would get a draw here and there, but that was it. It was a rough year and a half. And everybody says, well, why did you stay?
Yeah.
Why didn't you leave? Why didn't you quit? And I said, I've been there from day one. I think I'm part of what was developed. I think I'm an important part of it.
Yeah.
I put a lot of work, a lot of time away from family and I thought I deserved to stay there to the end and see how it played out. Didn't work out, like we all would wanted it to, but I had to stay. I couldn't walk away.
Yeah. And, kind of on a side here, you know, people talk, you always hear the term ECW originals, right? And you hear all these names that when people talk, oh, ECW is known for this and that. You guys as referees, obviously it's not your role to be in the spotlight, but you're often overlooked because you guys were there probably longer than most of the talent. And
him and I were the only two people that were there from day one to the very last day.
Yeah.
There's nobody else.
Yeah.
And people were in and out, went to WCW, went to WWE. There's nobody other than him and I that can say we were there from day one to the end.
Yeah. And then obviously, you know, you guys got involved here and there a little bit, but right. It's part of your role to not stand out, right? Outshine.
That's one of my pet peeves today with some of the referees on TV.
Oh, yeah.
They're out there posing. And I mean, you should have some type of reaction every now and then. And not like a lot of the people do now. It's just a little bit over the top for my liking. And I hate to sound like the old guy nitpicking something I'm watching on TV, but it just drives me. I always find myself looking at the referee and seeing what's going on, and it just drives me crazy sometimes.
But you
get your moments, and you'll get your spots, but that's not our job. Our job is to be there to make sure the match is going well and to protect the guys in there, communicating with the guys in there when needed, and. Just the way why I was brought up and taught, and that's just the way it'll always be.
Yeah, I am curious about that. So when you watch wrestling, do you key on that referee? Do you just find your eyes tend to
immediately?
Yeah,
like immediately. I have my favorites. I mean, not favorites. I won't mention any names, but I just find myself doing it all the time. I just can't get away from it.
Yeah, I imagine that's just the way it is, right? If you do it for so long.
Yeah.
That's what you're watching.
I mean, every now and then too. I mean, you get people that'll message you or something like that. Hey, did you see this? Did you say that? And I'm more than happy to point it out, but I would never go out and try to find somebody and say, hey, listen, stupid, you're not supposed to be doing it that way or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just always find myself, zeroing in on the ref.
Yeah. I have a buddy that I went to school with, right. He's from the same town as me. He refs in WWE, Jason Ayers. And,
great.
Yeah. And, he's a good guy. Very, very humble, very kind. And I tend to watch him when I'm, you know, I don't watch a lot of modern product, but when I do, I watch him because, right, I know him, right, and everything. So,
right.
I was always curious about that. If that happens, you know, if you cue in on refs,
yeah,
and absolutely. I imagine you do. Did you work the last ECW show in Pine Bluff?
I did not. Last one I did was the pay-per-view. Was the pay-per-view in New York, and I was not buying a plane ticket. I actually used to buy my own plane tickets, and I would get reimbursed for it.
Yeah,
and as soon as. And that's one thing I was never screwed over. I always got paid for the plane tickets I bought, but towards the end, I didn't travel a lot anywhere where I didn't think I would get reimbursed for it. I knew it was done that night of that pay-per-view. I said, I shook Paul's hand when I left. And I said, well, first I got Tommy to get in the meeting because we hadn't had money in a while. I said, Tommy, I got to talk to him. I got to get something out of him. And I told him, I said, Paul, I cannot go home without some kind of cash in my pocket. And he pulled out a wad of cash. He's probably waiting for everybody else to ask for it too. Filled off some money, gave it to me. We shook hands. And I said, thanks for everything. And hope to see you down the road somewhere.
Yeah. And you mentioned a few matches and things that you're in. Tell us, what's a story that you might have? Maybe not be a match or whatever that maybe you don't get to tell very often from maybe backstage. Has anything jumped to mind? Something peculiar, something off the wall. Doesn't have to be necessarily match.
There wasn't a lot. Every now and then you would have maybe guys butting heads. I found myself in the middle in Scranton, PA in a shouting match between Sandman and Shane Douglas. And I was the first guy in between them. They were upset about something. I don't even remember what it was, but I'm thinking to myself, why am I the guy standing here? We got a bunch of gorillas standing around, not doing anything. I'm the guy standing in between these two guys. But other than that, no, there really wasn't a lot. I mean, there was ribs here and there that, we're funny on the road. And the one I always love is Rockin' Rebel. I don't know if you remember that name.
I do.
He was early ECW. He was TWA. He came over, one of the guys that came over. And he always had an attitude about himself. Of course, we know that what happened with his history, but we'll stay away from that.
Yeah.
But he always had an attitude and was an ass most of the time. It really rubbed people the wrong way. So he came to Paul, complained that he never got a championship run. So this was a week before the Wildwood show. The next week in the Wildwood show, there was a battle royal. Winner would face Shane Douglas at the end of the night. So Paul, me, Francine, Shane, and Rebel sat down, and Paul says to him straight, he was straight faced the whole time, we're going to put you over in the battle royal, and you'll wrestle Shane and we'll talk about why that's going to happen. I have a couple ideas, but you're going to definitely wrestle Shane. So you'll be over in the battle royal. So the battle royal was first of the night. Everybody's in the ring. Everybody in that locker room was buzzed other than Rebel to know what was going on, to jump him as soon as that bell rang and throw him out first. Bell rang, everybody stormed. And I got to give him credit. He was a strong kid. and he grabbed onto that bottom rope and was holding on for dear life, yelling, "No, no, I'm supposed to go over. I'm supposed to go over." Wrestler Shane, they finally peeled him off, threw him over. Went over the top rope. He looked up, and there's Paul outside the curtain just looking at him, smiling. And he put his head down and walked to the back. And he understood after that.
Oh, that's funny. So when you look back on ECW, what's the first things that pop to mind for you?
Still to this day, I am shocked that you still hear ECW chants in arenas, no matter what wrestling you're looking at, whether somebody pulls out a chair or something, some kind of spot in the ring, and people start, you never hear anybody chant AWA, Memphis Wrestling, Global, or anything like that. To this day, people are still chanting ECW in arenas, no matter what show you're watching, and that just blows my mind. I don't think you'll ever experience that again from another promotion.
Yeah, I've always said I think ECW changed the trajectory of wrestling and what they did. I just think they were a step ahead on knowing what was going to happen, and they helped shape that the future. I mean, the big two emulated them. So, I mean, you had to say there's something they're doing.
There's no Attitude Era without ECW.
Absolutely.
I mean, Sandman is Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's easy as that. It's simple as that. Anybody who doesn't see that's crazy.
Yep.
There's no Attitude Era without it.
I agree. So I know you're still out there. You're still working. You're still making appearances, still doing some things here and there. I know you've tried a couple podcasts here and there with Jim and a couple other guys. And you're still kind of out there. Is there anything you want to plug or anything before?
Yeah, I'm actually still wrestling for one group, ECWA, which is the old Jim Kettner Super 8 promotion.
Yep.
A friend of mine who owns it now, I've known for, God, I guess it's close to 12 years now. And he bought it from Mike Tartaglia. And I still do. That's the only show I do now. I really have no interest in trying to find every booking that I can to ref.
Yeah.
I enjoy the guys that are there. I enjoy still doing it. And it's a nice escape night out with the guys and being able to get in the ring and roll around. I did a couple conventions over the years. It always blows my mind, those conventions too, that people come and see the same people over and over. How many more Bret Hart autographs can you get?
Yeah, really.
These guys are all over the place.
I know it.
The wrestling fan is the best. They are the best. They spend their money and they're loyal. But yeah, as far as me, that's pretty much all I'm doing right now. I just work for ECWA. Actually, we have a show this Saturday in Morganville, New Jersey. So if you're in the area, come on out. Cool. And would love to chat with you.
All right. And then, so do you have any social media out there that for people to follow you, or do you?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. My real name is John Finnegan. Okay. At the ref, JWF, Twitter and Instagram I'm on, but I'm not really too active on it.
Well, I'd love to see some.
I'm easy to find.
I'd love to see some of your podcasts. I was enjoying the Before It Was Extreme one that you and Joel and Jim were doing.
That was fun. And unfortunately, Joel had some health issues. That's why we really had to put it to an end. And he still is. So I don't know when that's coming back. I actually did an ECW with the same Ryan Cavanaugh, who now owns ECWA, a while back, and our schedules just. I still have my normal day job, and I work for the Phillies for security over the Phillies baseball team.
Oh, yeah.
So for 6 months, it's like hectic over here, and our schedules just never were able to get together to do it. Routinely.
You're still heartbroken over the Phillies? They didn't?
Yeah. Oof. The last two games were terrible. Man, oh, man.
I'm a Cardinals fan, but obviously we had zero chances here. We had a horrible year. But I am a fan of the Phillies, right? I do like the Phillies.
Yeah, they're a likable team. They're a fun team.
Yeah, I really grew fond of the Phillies back in whatever the 90s with Dykstra and Crook and all those guys. And I like those hard nose type players, those dirty, get dirt on their uniform. And they had a whole team full of them, man. And
speaking of Dykstra, just a quick, real quick thing. At one of the conventions at the old ECW arena that Ralph Feinstein put on, Lenny Dykstra was there as well. And he's a big wrestling fan. Let's just say Lenny was feeling well when he was there, and he was mingling with all the ECW guys. I got a great picture. I'll have to send it to you. I'll shoot it to you when I do it. But that was a fun day with him over there.
I bet. I've heard some tales. I've heard tales about Lenny. Right? He lived up to his reputation. But I always loved to watch. I love guys like that. Right? I love guys that just leave it all in the field and aren't afraid to get their uniform dirty and play hard. And man, those some of those Phillies teams back then, they had a whole team full of them with him and Crook.
Absolutely.
And Mitch Williams and all those guys, man. They were
93 Phillies. That was a great run. Me and my dad were there when they clinched the National League Championship. Last row of the vet when they clinched it. That was a fun run.
Yeah. I'm not necessarily a Rangers fan or whatever else, but I guess it's nice to see a new franchise win the first series.
I think it's their first, isn't it?
It's their first.
It's first that they won. That's good.
Yeah.
So, it's a shame that the Astros laid an egg. I would hope they put up a better World Series, but yeah. Rangers look good.
It's something. I always like history, and it's, I guess, you know, when a franchise wins their first series, I guess that's history. So.
Yep. Yes, indeed.
Well, so, hey, John, thanks for joining us. And, you know, maybe we can revisit and do it again. I don't like keeping guys too long, but I know you got a lot more stories you can tell. So maybe somewhere down the road, we'll do a part two and have you come on.
Absolutely.
And
you know where to find me. We'd love to.
Yeah. Well, we'll get more. Maybe we'll talk more specific matches and shows in particular. I wanted to kind of get an overview of, you know, of your time here tonight. But, you know, like I said, in the future, maybe we could have you back on and talk more specifics and more specific matches.
Great. Sounds fun to me. Absolutely.
All right.
Support This Is Extreme and buy the This Is Extreme shirt. Show the world that you are part of the revolution and that you support our podcast and the history of ECW. Go to tinyurl.com/ECW pod shirt and buy yours today.
This is Extreme. All right, and welcome back to This Is Extreme. Thank you to John Finnegan for coming on and chatting with me. Again, we'll have him on again in the future. Like I said at the conclusion of the interview, I just wanted to have him on to get kind of an overview of him and his time with ECW and some of his memories. We'll have him back on in the future and talk more specifics of shows, matches, and things like that. So look forward to that coming up. Remember, wherever you listen to your podcast, make sure you subscribe to us. We're on all the podcast platforms. And if applicable, please give us a rating and review, as that helps us in those algorithms that when people are listening to wrestling podcasts, we come up as a suggested listen. Like I mentioned earlier, make sure you follow us on social media. The podcast is on X, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Just look up ECW Pod, and you can follow me personally on X at The Dave Dynasty. And one of the best ways that you can support the show is to go and buy one of our shirts. Just visit tinyurl.com/ECW Pod shirt and buy one of the This Is Extreme shirts. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being a fan of ECW and keeping that extreme spirit alive. I love that this is the promotion that just, even though it's not active, it just won't die. It's still out there. Still get the chance, and it's wonderful. And that's why we get to do things like this and these history podcasts and all the other the watch along podcasts and how all the superstars of ECW are still out there making appearances and doing interviews. It's great. It's why these guys and all of us can do these things. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode, so look for us there. But until then, wherever you go and whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep it extreme.